Welcome to the Next Stage Business Radio Show. I'm your host, Pamela Muldoon, and it is officially the first day of spring, March 20th, 2010. Yay. Got Josh smiling. I got Jeff in the studio. We're all grinning because it is officially the first day of spring, and I'm always excited about that because that means we're going to put winter to sleep, hopefully soon for good, and I'm really excited about that because there's something about spring in Minnesota. We just absolutely love it. And there's something about business in Minnesota. Hey, like that segue, guys. All right. Again, this is the Next Stage Business Radio Show. Glad to have you along for the next couple of hours. We're here from 1 to 3 every Saturday afternoon live. And of course, we're also live via the web. So if you're in and out of your car, but you're hopping back into a building and happen to have a laptop or computer access or have friends around the state of Minnesota or even around the globe, it's nextstagebusinessradio.com. If you're a tweeter, we would love to get you involved in the show. We have a hashtag for the show. It's hashtag NSB Radio, and of course, our Twitter handle is at NSB Radio Show. So feel free to tweet at will if you choose to do so. We appreciate that. And we, as always, have a great show coming up again here for the next couple of hours. In just a little bit, we're going to be chatting with a couple of attorneys. I'm surrounded by attorneys. We've got a couple of attorneys from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. Of course, our very own Jeffrey O'Brien is in the house. And also from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen, Phil Trobaugh is here. And we're going to be talking employment issues today. Things to consider from an employer perspective and also an employee perspective in terms of just some legal stuff from social media to no compete. We're going to have an employment conversation in just a little bit. And we also have our organization of the week here in the 1 o'clock hour. This week's organization that's being spotlighted is the National Association of Professional Organizers. I'm really excited. We have the president of the Minnesota chapter, Sheila Dingles, is in the house, and she's going to be chatting about why we need to consider this organization stuff for our business and, of course, our home and learn more about the association. In our 2 o'clock hour, we have our business spotlight coming up. Our Next Stage Business Radio's very own Connie Anderson, company is Word and Deeds. She's going to be on as our business spotlight today. I'm really excited to have her on the show. Good friend of mine. And, ladies and gentlemen, our leaders and teachers segment in the 2 o'clock hour. I have Scott Littman coming on. He is the co-founder of Minnesota Cup, which is a business competition. So here in the Twin Cities, it's in its sixth year, and we're going to be sharing all about the history of the Minnesota Cup as well as how you can start to get involved. They open up competition next weekend. So we have a jam-packed show, and we're really excited to get locked and loaded, as I like to say. So I'm going to go ahead and get going with our team of advisors, and I do have a little bit of a team going on today, don't I, Jeff?
You do.
I'm kind of excited. All right, so we've got Jeff O'Brien here with Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. Hi, Jeff. How you doing?
I am doing well. How are you?
Excellent. I'm just in a good mood because there's sun and there's no snow. That makes me happy.
Don't jinx it, though.
Okay, knock on wood. I'm knocking on some kind of wood here. And then, of course, another gentleman is on the phone this afternoon, Phil Trobaugh from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. Phil, are you there?
Hi, folks. Thanks, Pamela, for having me on. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Phil.
Hey, hi, Phil. How are you this afternoon? Are you enjoying this day?
It's a great day out there. I can't wait to get out of there and play with my kids.
Oh, there you go. It's a great day to hang out with the family. And we really appreciate you taking some time today to share with our audience your area of expertise. And so why don't we start with where I like to start at the very beginning. Now, we've gotten to know Jeff over the past few weeks. And Phil, you're a new addition to the show. So why don't we start with a little bit of who you are and your role at Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen, and maybe a little bit of background in your area of expertise.
Sure. Thanks for having me again. I've been an attorney with the firm since 1992. I graduated from Hamlin Law, and I'm originally from Wisconsin. And
we won't hold that against you.
Good neighbors, Rob.
We are. No, I lived in Wisconsin for many years. So
terrific.
Good stuff.
My practice area is mainly in employment law. I represent both employers and employees who had business issues and employment issues. I also have a side issue practice with education law, and it's sort of a specialized employer. But that's what I do. I'm a litigator. I'm in court a lot, and I represent folks, and I help to bring people together and help resolve their disputes.
Well, and I'm sure your employers and employees, because that's really where we want to, you know, talk a little bit about both sides, the talent you bring to the table, obviously depending on the situation, is going to be a huge beneficial piece to either side. So why don't we start with just some of the employment law basics? I've been an employee before in the past. Now I own my own business, but I know that when I signed up to work for a company, it was an at-will employment. Why don't you explain what that really means and how that kind of falls into play here?
Most states in the country are what we call at-will employment, and I think there's only one state out there that is not, and that's Montana. But at-will employment means basically if you're a private business, so you're not a government entity, you're not a unionized workforce, you don't have employees with specialized contracts, that would all mean that you're an at-will employer. And at-will means that you can fire an employee for a good reason or a bad reason. And on the other side of it, as an employee, you can quit for a good reason or bad reason. But back to the employer, you cannot fire somebody for an illegal reason. And there are some sort of general categories of reasons why an employer may not fire an employee. For example, on the basis of some form of discrimination, age, race, sex, disability, religion, things like that. You cannot base your decision to fire somebody on one of those reasons. Likewise, you're precluded from firing an employee as retaliation for some sort of legitimate whistleblowing that an employee has done. But barring kind of those two broad areas, an employer is well within their rights to terminate somebody, like I said, for a good reason or bad reason. There's some reasons why you might want to have a good reason to terminate somebody. For example, if you were fighting somebody on their unemployment benefits because they committed some sort of misconduct, it would be a good thing to do to make sure that you've got some good documentation to prove that should there be an administrative hearing.
Well, and you're bringing up a really interesting point, Phil, because what's starting to go through my mind as you're talking about this is documentation. So what are some of the challenges that you see as a business attorney in this at-will process, that some of the mistakes that business owners make when they really do have cause, but they haven't really kept up their end of the bargain, per se? What are some of the most common mistakes you see from a business owner's perspective?
Companies working so hard to keep the business up because of the economy or other business pressures that they neglect to follow through in making sure that they document timely when it happens, if there's an incident of either misconduct or poor performance, failing to inform the employee of these failings. That can also be a problem because then the employee's kind of on this, is sailing along thinking everything is fine, and they suddenly get fired and they're thinking, well, what the heck did I do? Nobody ever told me that there was a problem. Then they file for unemployment, for example, and they discover to their shock and horror, oh my gosh, I've got all these other issues that they never brought to my attention before. That can really backfire on an employer, especially if they've not had policies that they've kept up to date, if they've not given prior warnings. An unemployment judge might say, well, if you've never informed the employee of these problems, you've never informed them of the rules, never gave them any warnings, how are they to know that their behavior or their performance was not up to par? I'm going to give that person their unemployment. So it really makes sense to make sure you've got a good policy manual and to brush that up every couple of years. Don't let that get stale. And also make sure that you maintain on a regular basis a good personnel file. And if you have issues with the employee, make sure you discuss that either in writing or in person, and then go back to the file. It doesn't take a lot of time, just a couple of sentences to make sure that that's all kept up to date.
Now, you mentioned letting the employee know if there's any ongoing concerns. Is there any particular time or expectation, if something's put into a file but the employee is not aware, what are some of the parameters that a business owner really needs to be following? Is there a certain time frame that they need to be notifying the employee? Just to kind of give us some, tips on that as well, if you would.
Yeah, every business is going to do things a little bit differently and tailor things to their own way. If you're going to have a yearly annual evaluation, make sure that you stick to that and keep it to the same time every year.
Okay.
Don't let it drift. I get a lot of people who call me, and one of the main reasons they're upset is because the employer has either ceased to give performance reviews or has done them in such a cursory manner that they're left being confused and hurt and upset when they get a bad review. And sometimes, I don't know if it's a Minnesota Nice thing or what, but sometimes we have difficulty confronting people about tough issues.
Sure.
And I would tell employers, bite the bullet. You don't have to be a mean person to do it. Just be firm but polite. Here are the problems or here are the issues in which to improve and make sure that that's communicated. Circle back to the file and just note that on such and such a day we met, here's what we discussed, here were the areas of concern. That's really all it needs in order to make, kind of pass that first muster.
Well, and a couple of things as you're sharing this information, I think these are really great tips, and you're absolutely right. You had indicated earlier the business owner is so busy with the day-to-day operation, and if it's a small business, they're wearing a lot of hats. And so
right.
I'm also hearing, you know, your team of advisors along with the attorney, I mean, having a good human resources consultant or person on site to make sure that you have updated documentation, because laws change, don't they?
Yeah, they change, and the time can go by so quickly because you're so busy that the next thing you know, it was 6 months ago that something happened. You meant to put something in the file. Now if you're writing it 6 months later,
sure.
It looks like you're maybe ginning it up to make it sound worse than it was, or maybe you didn't remember everything that you wanted to put in that's really germane to the issue.
Now, and in terms of the file, I just kind of want to stick on this a little bit as some really great basics, because
sure.
You're actually, you know, bringing up some interesting, it's funny how when I talk to my advisors here on this show, I start thinking about what it was like when I worked for somebody else, and I'm like, why didn't I do that? So from an employee perspective, then I should also be taking some responsibility here and taking a look at my file. I have rights around checking my own personnel file, is that correct?
You do. You have a right to look at it. I think it's once a year. You have a right to have a copy made. But there's also, obviously, a social price that you pay.
Sure.
You're somebody who comes to their employer every year. I want to look at my file. It makes it sound like, you know, what is it that, you know, that there's a lack of trust between the two parties. So you have to be kind of careful about that. What I would suggest for employees, rather than doing that, is, you know, if you haven't heard in a while how you're doing performance-wise, is to just sort of check in with somebody, you know, 5 minutes or, you know, take your boss out to lunch or something to say, hey, how are things going? I thought I did really well on that Smith project. Did you agree with me on that? As a way to sort of check in to make sure things are good.
Yeah.
And, you know, be open to getting some constructive criticism, too. It's not always going to be a pat on the back.
Right, right. Well, I'm really glad that we've spent a little time talking about this, because obviously it's an interesting time with the unemployment and contracts and files, and it's just an interesting climate. And so we're going to take a little break, Phil, if that's okay. We've got some bills to pay ourselves. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to start going into that conversation of contracts, no-compete contracts, some employee contracting, some of the pros, cons, and things to look for. So we're going to be back in just a little bit. We've got Phil Trobaugh from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen, Jeffrey O'Brien nodding his head diligently here in the studio. This is Pamela Muldoon, Next Stage Business Radio Show on Business 1570. Welcome back to the Next Stage Business Radio Show. I'm your host, Pamela Muldoon, and we are talking to a couple of wonderful attorneys from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. We've got Phil Trobaugh on the line, and he is our employment law specialist this afternoon. But we also have in-house and in-studio Jeffrey O'Brien, a business attorney with Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. And I just want to pick up, before we start going back into some of this employment specifics, Jeff, from a perspective as a business attorney, you are dealing mainly with the business owner and getting things set up and moving into some of these conversations. How does this really apply from the role that you play as the business attorney, and why should we as business owners be concerned?
Well, Pamela, a lot of the startup businesses that I work with don't have employees, so it's not as I don't deal with it as much on that in that context as I do, like we talked last week, with the sale of the business and, you know, getting sales employees and others to sign contracts, non-compete contracts, which we'll talk about in a minute, and other employment contracts. But, you know, this is one of the nice things about being a business attorney with this firm, with Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen, is to have this team of employment lawyers. I mean, that's what this firm, when it started out, was most known for, was the employment law practice.
Sure.
And not every business law firm can tap a team of experts the way that we can at our firm. And so my job sometimes is to be the issue spotter. If I see an issue, whether it be on what could be, starting out the relationship with an employment offer letter, or having my client, get an employee handbook, or non-compete issues, or, back to when we talked a few weeks ago about intellectual property with trade secrets and inventions, having those types of things embedded into an agreement with an employee in terms of works for hire and things like that, and even to the end with severance. All those issues, those aren't my areas, so I'll go down the hall and talk to someone like Phil or another one of my colleagues that does employment law and help the client. So it's a team approach, and then it works nicely for me. You can only teach an old dog so many new tricks, and trying to have a business attorney play employment lawyer doesn't lead to good results.
Right. Well, it's, when I'm working with my clients in the marketing world, it's the more focused you are, the more money you make, right? So you've got your specialty. I always say this is one thing attorneys do really well, is once they get their wings under them, they start to realize there's one or two niches where it's really their thing, their
passion. That's exactly right.
And of course, so it sounds like, Jeff, you're kind of like the quarterback there. You've got the ball, and you're going to throw it to the right person at the right time.
Sometimes, yeah.
And like that analogy?
And sometimes it works the other way. Phil may be counseling someone and getting them out of a non-compete agreement because they want to start a new business.
Sure.
So there's a lot of back and forth between our employment group and our business group in terms of the way we help our clients.
Absolutely. So Phil, we were starting to, I wanted to tee up this concept of where we're at as a business owner, but there are a few reasons in terms of business contracts or employee contracts where I'm going to need to talk to someone like you. So why don't you give us an example of some of the common contracts, and maybe we can break a couple of these down here in the next few minutes as well. So give us some examples of contracts that are fairly common between an employer and an employee.
Well, most contracts that we're talking about still preserve the at-will status, and there aren't many employers out there who want to necessarily tie themselves to a particular employee for a period of time at a set salary.
Okay.
Where it's guaranteed employment, say for 2 or 3 or 4 years. That's pretty atypical. But where you do see agreements is in the realm of, say, protecting your confidential, your trade secret information. Having new employees sign agreements to say that they will not utilize that information for a third party or when they leave, or that if they have an invention while they're working for the employer, they agree to assign that invention to the employer. Those are sort of the more types of typical agreements that I see. Also, maybe an independent contractor agreement is a more typical arrangement where the person working for the business is not technically an employee. Is more like an outside consultant, but they're agreeing to do a certain amount of work for a certain rate of pay.
Sure.
But it's not like when you hear about a contract, it's not like the old days where, say, Humphrey Bogart signed a contract with MGM agreeing to do a certain number of movies at a certain salary, but only in the employment context. We don't usually have those types of situations. And the third, obviously, is the one we were going to be talking about, too, is the non-compete contract.
Right. And in terms of some of these contracts, you mentioned the independent consultant or the consulting kinds of contracts. Just out of curiosity, with the change and shift of employment in the last, we'll say, 18 months to 2 years, have you, as an employment law attorney, seen more of these independent contracts kind of being put into play in business? I mean, are we starting to see a shift here?
Well, I have not myself personally. Okay. Anecdotally, I've heard about it. I think it's a way for some employers to avoid some of the perhaps pitfalls or the more of the entanglements of having a formalized employment relationship. And it's also a way to, if done correctly, is a way to avoid having to pay unemployment tax. But the employer, the business, has to be careful in how they structure it, because the question that often comes about is, If the business is exercising a certain amount of control over that person, then even if you've signed this agreement, if the control looks like it's more or less an employment relationship, then it doesn't matter what you actually signed. They're going to look beyond that to see what the actual relationship is.
Sure.
So, for example, if you're telling this person on a daily basis what to do and when to do it and all of that sort of thing, you're more of an employer than a standalone two parties. On the other hand, if this is somebody who's working from home, they can pretty much direct how and when they're going to be doing the work and that sort of thing, then it may look like it's more of a pure independent contractor relationship.
Okay. And Jeff, you had something you wanted to add to the conversation on that?
A lot of our incubation center clients are people that were let go from employment and have started a consulting practice. And you know, so we're forming an entity and having a consulting agreement, and it has a certain magic language that the IRS likes to see in terms of what Phil was just talking about, in terms of the level of control and the consultant being able to do work on the hours they want, in the locations they want, and all those things. And that's been a big issue the last couple of years, is this independent contractor area, particularly, you know, I wear another hat with the firm as a real estate attorney, so I work with a lot of contractors. And 2 years ago, the state enacted a new statute where they really clamped down on, you know, in the housing industry and contractors using individuals as quote-unquote independent contractors.
Okay.
And there's actually a lot of, you know, you have to apply for exemptions, and it's moving more towards, if you want to avoid IRS scrutiny on the independent contractor versus employee issue, because it really comes down to a payroll tax issue.
Sure, yeah.
A lot more, it's certainly having the independent contractor be a business entity is going to be a lot, you're going to be in a lot better stead than if you try to do this, you make the argument as an individual. Then it gets into all these different tests about control and hours and all those kinds of stuff. So just letting somebody off your payroll and putting them back on and calling them an independent contractor because you don't want to pay employee benefits and withhold for them,
that's not enough. Easy.
Calling it an independent contractor, it's a substance, you know, substance over form. You may call it whatever you want. The IRS is going to look at the characters of what's actually going on in the relationship.
Excellent. Yeah, and I think that's a really valid point, because I think this is a something a lot of companies are considering or have considered doing in the past couple of years. And another area that I would think, Phil, is getting a lot of attention is that non-compete area, especially due to the many layoffs and you know, folks being transitioned, as we like to say. So give us a little sense of non-compete, what that really means, and I guess in a general sense, everyone's going to have their own specific contract, but what are some of the parameters, especially here in the state of Minnesota?
Non-competes are sort of specialized agreements to prevent employees from leaving and working for competitors, or leaving and creating competitors with their former employers. You see this more often in any type of industry where there's a lot of sensitive information, high-tech, software, medical device companies. This is the norm. You also see it in industries where there's a lot of one-on-one contact between, say, a sales representative or somebody providing a personal service and that company's customers.
Sure.
For example, any type of, you know, one-on-one sales representative industry, or we see a lot of these, believe it or not, in the healthcare and beauty industries. A lot of manicurists, a lot of hairdressers have to sign non-competes because they have such a hold on those customers. If they were to go and leave, those customers travel with them, and that can really kill a business. So these agreements are meant to try to forestall that in such a way so that it protects, hopefully, a legitimate business interest, but at the same time is not so onerous that it precludes the employee from working anywhere and not being able to have a living.
Well, and have you noticed in the employment law arena around this, with the many layoffs that have happened, how is that enforceable if you've been terminated or laid off versus having quit your position? Are there some different changes there, or some things that we should be aware of?
The law does not really analyze that in terms of whether somebody was fired versus a layoff or whether somebody was quit. The idea is, no matter why you left, we don't want you to work for a competitor.
Sure.
And so sometimes, you know, one of the myths that I hear spoken back to me from both employers and employees is, oh, well, Minnesota, they don't uphold these non-competes. They look upon with a lot of disfavor. And it is true that around the country, how these are looked at can be very different. For example, in California, they're outlawed completely. But here in Minnesota, they are, they can be upheld. In fact, I was just involved in a case, not too long ago, last month actually, where we were representing a smaller business. And we were able to stop an employee who was very valuable salesperson, their top salesperson, who had been, for a number of months before he resigned, had actually been starting the process of setting up his own competing business, unbeknownst to the employer. This fellow abruptly quits, and we learned that he was out there competing directly with our client, and we were able to get a very quick, what's called a temporary restraining order issued against that employee.
Okay.
But having said that, it doesn't mean that they're automatically enforceable. They have to be reasonable in scope, and I'm happy to go into that and talk about that.
Well, and we can go into a little bit of that. I think having some of those details would be important to have, but we're going to take a little break first, Phil, and when we come back, maybe share a couple of ways that they are enforceable and, you know, just to get a sense, because my guess is there are a lot of people out in the business world dealing with this right now, especially if they're starting their own businesses and they don't realize. I mean, sometimes a lot of this happens just simply out of non-education or not enough education. So we're going to be back in just a little bit. We're continuing to talk with Phil and Jeff here from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen on employment issues. This is Next Stage of Business Radio Show. I'm Pamela Muldoon on Business 1570. Welcome back to the Next Stage Business Radio Show. This is Pamela Muldoon. Get it in there. There we go. Gotta wait for the bridge. Gotta wait for it. And I am talking with Jeff O'Brien from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen, and also Phil Trobaugh from Mansfield, Tannick & Cohen. And we are discussing employment issues. Before we went to break, Phil was sharing a little bit about the non-compete, just some guidelines around that. And was there a little more in-depth conversation, Phil, that we wanted to travel down that in terms of things to be aware of with the non-compete?
Well, I think in terms of tips, I would urge employers who are considering doing this or who have done this to avoid using the forms or taking something out of a book that they found because each one of these needs to be kind of tailored specifically to each business.
Okay.
And not that we want to do excessive legal work here, but one of the problems that we had in this case that I was talking about is we were dealing with a non-compete that was taken from a form book, and while we still prevailed, it provided some issues to the other side that we normally would not have been able to have to deal with.
Sure.
So I think having an attorney provide some language for you is very helpful in terms of, you know, keeping the terms of the non-compete reasonable, which is what courts look for. You cannot, for example, preclude somebody from working for a competitor indefinitely. It has to be for a fairly short period of time. In Minnesota, that's generally between 2 and 3 years at the very most.
Okay.
3 years is pretty much an outlier. But and even in, say, software businesses, there is some case law that says that 6 months might be the limit because the information and the technology changes so quickly that to preclude somebody from working for a competitor beyond 6 months is really unreasonable.
Right.
And then also, depending on the industry, what's the geographical area that you're going to be trying to prohibit the employee from working in? In this hairdresser or beauty industry, usually a radius of a certain number of miles is all that you need. You don't need to preclude somebody who's living in the Twin Cities from working in Milwaukee. That's not going to cut it.
Most of us don't drive that far for a haircut. You got to be pretty darn good.
Not most people. So usually in those industries, we see something like a 5 mile or even a 10 mile radius.
Okay.
But in other industries, you know, if you were working in the medical devices, or let's say you're working for you're working with chemicals or software. Sometimes we even see a global restriction, which could be reasonable, depending again on the industry.
Absolutely.
If you're working for a Medtronic or one of these huge companies, it makes sense. They do business all over the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, these are some really good tips, and it's interesting the industry perspective really does come into play. So that's all important in the non-compete. And, we have a few minutes yet that we have to discuss. And another area that is... it's the sexy hot topic on everybody's, business right now, and it's called social media, right?
That's right.
I understand that this is an area that you've also done some really great work in. So let's talk a little bit about social media policy. Why should I, as a business, start to consider this, and what are some things I should consider when putting together a policy around this?
Well, let me give you a couple of quick statistics to give you the sense of how prevalent this is in the workplace. I just saw something the other day that said we're approaching 10 billion tweets.
Yes.
Twitter hasn't been around for very long.
No.
People are tweeting all the time. If you have a workforce and you employ anybody who's been born after 1961, the estimates are that close to 75% of that population and younger are utilizing social media networks, going online at work. at some point during the day. So
right.
your employees are doing that. If you're a business that provides internet access in some form or fashion, your employees, you know, the odds are your employees are doing that during the work time, during the workday.
Yes.
As well as doing it when they're not at work. So it's important to, I think, have thought through, number one, are we going to be a business that allows this in some fashion during work? If so, we better have a policy. If we're not going to allow it at work, we better tell them so that they're alerted to that. And even if we're not going to allow them to do it at work, we better have a policy that says, that gives them some rules and guidelines about what we're going to prohibit them from doing while they're not at work. We don't want them, for example, while they're not at work, trashing our business.
Right.
Or trashing another employee or doing something that would somehow reflect poorly on our business. So we better have some policies about that. And then I think lastly you want to consider, are we the type of business that we want to have a presence on a social networking site? And if so, what would be the purpose of that? How would we have our employees interact with that as a way of getting some additional marketing and advertising? So those are the kind of the four big areas that I see employers needing to address, smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses that haven't thought about that. You're going to be thinking about it in the next 12 months.
Well, and one of the things that I think about when you talk about, like, for example, an employee participating on these social media tools outside of work, what is that fine line between what I can tell someone to do on their, you know, when they're at home or on their own time versus what I can tell them to do or guide them to do while I'm at work, right?
That's right. I think if you're going to be using a guideline, it's what is it that's going to be reasonable for protecting your own business. You don't want to be telling employees what they should or should not be saying about politics or religion or things of that nature or things you don't care about. But what you care about is how it's going to reflect back on you.
Right.
So, you want to make sure that they don't do anything that would otherwise violate the law, number one.
Right.
Or other things that would be embarrassing. You know, we don't want to see or find out that you've been posting pictures of your latest barbecue or maybe you've had one or two more beers than you
right.
should have.
I call it the two-drink maximum.
That's right. We don't want you defaming other employees. We don't want you disclosing any confidential or trade secret information. I mean, those are things that the law would be very strong in terms of protecting.
Yeah.
Once you have a policy in place and it's been communicated clearly to the workforce.
This topic alone, as we're talking, I'm getting more and more questions in my head. We could probably do a whole show, Jeff, just on social media policy.
I'm sure Phil would be willing to come back and do that one.
Would you be willing to come back and break that down? Because we've heard of all sorts of horror stories from people who have gotten fired because of something they said, or you know, they call in sick and then someone's caught on Facebook. I mean, we're hearing all these little horror stories. And then, of course, I know this doesn't necessarily fall into employment law, but just kind of, you know, the theory that insurance companies want to start raising, you know, rates because you're telling them, you know, people you're not at home, you know, and just there's a whole world that's really starting to shift. And I think we haven't even realized some of the repercussions yet.
Yeah. I mean, it's just really, social networking sites have been around for about a decade, but with MySpace and Facebook just zooming in the last 2 or 3 years, it's really catching some employers off guard. Just how wide, incredible that this is taking place. I mean, it used to be, if you surfed the web at work, it was pretty one-sided. You were maybe doing a little bit of shopping, or maybe you're looking at basketball scores or something like that.
Right.
Now you're communicating back and forth on a fairly regular basis about all things under the sun, and you're not really thinking through how might that affect my job, or how might that affect my business, or my own reputation.
Right.
And I think both employers and employees need to be much more conscious about that. We're talking about people in professions and careers here, not somebody who's in college who uses Facebook or Twitter without really thinking about the implications.
Right.
But more and more people like those are coming into the workplace.
And it all started because some kid just wanted to talk to his friends. it's kind of blown up, yeah. Well, you know, our time today, it always goes so fast. Is there anything that you wanted to add to this, Jeff? I know you use these tools quite a bit, and of course you're very conscious of how you use them. But just our last few seconds here, is there anything you wanted to share or add on the back end?
Well, obviously, as the, I'm the marketing partner for our firm, and so I use these tools to market our firm. And, you know, we try to, I think there's only one of our attorneys that's on Twitter. A bunch of us are on Facebook. Almost all of us, I think, are on LinkedIn. It's just in terms of kind of creating a strategy in terms of, you know, we're all kind of saying the same message
sure.
about our firm. And so that, you know, it's this kind of consistency of message in terms of what our brand is. I mean, our firm, because of the amount of stuff that we write on and speak on and stuff, we were kind of uniquely positioned to take advantage of social media by putting out a lot of our content out into the Twitterverse and
right.
Facebook world and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And it's just a matter of, so it's I think it's a little bit easier for us in terms of how we manage it, because it's easy. We all write articles.
Right.
And one person, me,
lots of high content,
kind of pushes the controls and gets it out there. So, I think it would be great to come back and do another discussion about this whole
topic. I would love to. Phil, if you're game, I think we'll definitely have you come back and do just a whole discussion on the ins and outs of social media policy.
Fantastic.
Well, guys, as always, I'd love to have Mansfield Tannick on the show. Phil Trobaugh from Mansfield Tannick & Cohen, thanks for calling in today. We appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
And we look forward to chatting with you again soon. Of course, Jeff O'Brien, a business attorney at Mansfield Tannick & Cohen as well. And website, mansfieldtannick.com.
Mansfieldtannick.com. Both Phil's email and profiles on there, as well as mine.
Excellent. All right. Well, when we come back, we're going to have Sheila Dingles, the National Association of Professional Organizers president, on deck for Org of the Week. This is Next Stage Business Radio. I'm Pamela Muldoon on Business 1570.